With that, I will call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. It is Thursday, March 31st, 2022, and we are holding this meeting remotely per Rule 10.01. First, we'll start with the roll. Michaela, go ahead.
Eckerfin.
Present.
Mueller.
Present.
Scott. Representative Scott.
Here.
Feist?
Present.
Frazier?
Present.
Grossel? Representative Grossel? Herr?
Present.
Collins?
Present.
Johnson? Representative Johnson? Liebling?
Present.
Long?
Present.
Mortensen?
Mortensen present.
Novotny?
Novotny present.
Farr?
Farr present.
Robbins?
Present.
Bang? Representative Bang? Zhang?
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. First thing on the agenda is approval of the minutes for March 29th, 2022. Representative Robbins, can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, the minutes are now before us. Any discussion to the minutes for March 29th? All right, not seeing any hands. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Right, the minutes are adopted. Minutes are approved. And with that, we'll get right to it. So as you remember, members, we had House File 3605, which Representative Rasmussen presented and told us about on Tuesday. We now properly have the bill in our possession. So I will move that House File 3605 be referred to the General Register. Any questions? Otherwise, we'll get right to the roll. All right. I will renew my motion that House File 3605 be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Eckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel? Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Farr?
Farr, aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and 0 nays.
Motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the General Register. Members, now I'm going to hand over the virtual gavel to Vice Chair Mueller for most of the rest of the day. Vice Chair Mueller, the gavel is yours.
Thank you, Chair Eckerfin. So next up on the agenda is House File 2739, Civil Legal Services Funding. Chair Eckerfin, would you like to move that your bill, House File 2739, be referred to Ways and Means?
Yes, I will move the House File 2739 be referred to Ways and Means. We'll go right ahead. So this relates to the hearing we had back in January where we heard a lot about what the services that are provided by legal aid throughout our state. And so this is the actual bill that provides that funding that would get them at a level where they could actually meet more of the needs of people throughout the state. And given that we've discussed this at length in our first meeting back in January, I will go to my testifiers to talk more about it.
Thank you. First up, we have Dori Rappaport. If you are here, I'm not seeing you on my screen, but I assume you're here. Please go ahead and introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair. I am Dori Rappaport, and I am here with my colleague, Anne Hefkin, who I believe will be sharing her screen so we can provide you with some additional information today in regards to our request. So thank you. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair. And thank you to members of the committee. And thank you, Dory. And I believe you are all seeing my screen now.
We are. And can you please just introduce yourself for the record?
Of course. My name is Ann Hefkin. I am the Executive Director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota.
Thank you. Welcome. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you so much. We are glad to be here today to talk to you again about the request for civil legal services. And so just a reminder, we're here to talk to you about the main problems facing civil legal services right now. And the number one issue for us is our salary crisis. I'm going to be frank. Our staff attorneys are still at 55,200. That's what they're starting at right now. With the current allocation that civil legal services is slated for, by July 1st, that would bring our average to 60,335. We're asking for an additional 4.3% to allow us to bring those starting salaries to 65,000 so we can have an actual seat at the table, because right now we're not able to retain and recruit attorneys. So for example, we have a number of staff attorney positions open across the state right now. I just took a survey actually this morning, and our fellow partners have 11% across the state, 11% of our staff attorney positions are currently open and can't be filled. And some of those positions have been open for months. This is part of a pandemic crisis, but this is really part of a civil legal services is not at the table when it comes to having even comparable salaries for public service positions. And so as a result, we are seeing significant turnover, not just an inability to recruit, but an inability to retain. And so I'm going to turn it over to my colleague to talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you. The turnover rate in 2021 for all of civil legal services was 37% of all staff, as you can see from the slide. That is not sustainable. This is not a problem that is focused in just metro areas or rural areas. They each have their challenges, but it is statewide. And as a result, what happens is that it's a resource drain. The cost to recruit and then train new staff is significant, the amount of time and resources that that takes. In my program alone, for example, there was a 25-plus year staff attorney who last August, after many, many years of being recruited by the county attorney's office, left our program to work for the county attorney. And he took a huge increase in salary as a result. It just was an offer he couldn't pass up. And when you lose someone with that level of experience, you lose their ability to handle a high number of cases and to serve a high number of clients. So what is a result is a dip in services to our clients. And increased salaries is a start. It's a starting point. And as I noted, when we have this level of turnover, we're unable to serve the low-income Minnesotans that need our services. In 2021, more than half, 55% of every low-income person who had a civil legal aid issue and found our services, we had to turn away and we weren't able to fully serve because of lack of resources. This is a result of two things. Number one, that turnover of staff, the lack of retention of staff, that 37% turnover rate, but it's also a result of the pandemic and the disproportionate impact that the pandemic has had on our client communities. Our vulnerable, low-income communities of color in Minnesota have been hit disproportionately. And that impact has been seen in our offices, and we're turning away more and more people all the time. It's the worst it's ever been, unfortunately. The types of cases that we're seeing are spikes in issues related to safety and domestic violence, people who need a lawyer to help them get safety. We're also seeing it in the area of housing law, huge numbers of evictions, and as a result, homelessness. When civil legal aid is able to step in, we're twice as likely to be able to keep somebody in their home when someone has a lawyer in an eviction as opposed to when they do not. Barriers to employment, disability issues, access to education. There's a whole number of cases that we're seeing higher numbers of as a result of the pandemic. And unfortunately, because of our salary crisis, because of our lack of resources, we're not able to serve all of them.
So the screen you're looking at right now, or the slide you're looking at right now, is the ARC. So Chair Becker-Finn has asked us to talk about what it would take to fully fund civil legal services. And hopefully this shows you sort of the timeline of where we could potentially be to be able to have 100% impact for Minnesotans. So right now, we are currently funded at a level where we have just shy of 500 FTE for civil legal services. Now, Anne did talk about how many people we turned away, but we did help a lot of people in 2021 because our staff work incredibly hard to help a wide variety of individuals with a number of issues that Anne talked about. So in 2021, we closed 43,762 cases. That impacted 95,992 Minnesotans. And that's at that far left level that we just talked about, our current funding. So if we were to receive the $4.3 million, that would help us stabilize salaries. And we would also be able to start staff attorneys at 65,000. We would keep the same number of FTE at that level, but it would help stop some of the bleeding. Now, if you look over to the third prong here, you'll see we've increased that FTE by another 75 FTE, which is about the FTE we asked for in the temporary emergency funding, which I'll get to in just a moment. And you can see that that would help us increase the need. And we would be able to meet 58% of the total need if we were funded at that level. But ultimately, at 84 million, that's when we would be able to meet 100% of the need with what we project at 1,270 FTE across the state to provide critical civil legal services to low-income individuals. If you could go to the next slide, Anne. Thank you. So to lay it out simply, this is what we're looking at today. We are looking for that 4.3 million to help us stabilize our staffing and move those starting salaries by July 1st to 65,000 for staff attorneys. But we're also asking for emergency staffing and technology. I just talked about 75 more FTE for civil legal services. And over the course of the next 3 years, we want to be able to respond to that increased need that we're seeing as a result of the pandemic. This would allow us to start to do that. And so the majority of this funding would go towards emergency staffing. The technology would allow us to address the digital divide. Court remains virtual. Court has seen many efficiencies in remaining virtual. We've seen many efficiencies in remaining virtual, but our low-income communities need an investment in the digital infrastructure to allow them to access civil legal services and the courts. This is justice, digital justice, that we need to ensure Minnesotans have access to. And we've started that. We have the Reach Justice Project. It's allowed us to bring internet and bring services across the state of Minnesota through mobile legal offices and through legal kiosks. And so we're asking in this first year in 2023 for an additional investment in legal kiosks so we can bring more kiosks to community partners where people are accessing our services and appearing for courts. And then we're asking for that continued support while we continue to figure out what this new normal looks like for the justice system. We need an investment for low-income Minnesotans so that they're able to achieve civil justice. And so we are now able to take any questions. I think we've got one more ending slide there. There it is. Any questions that you have? Thank you so much for having us today.
All right, thank you. And if you could stop sharing your screen here so I can see if we've got any hands up or any. Chair Becker-Finn, you have your hand raised, so go right ahead.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to clarify that, you know, this is the bill before us today is what it would look like if we fully funded and we were at that 84 million ask. And so I just want to clarify for discussion purposes today, You know, that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about this vision of what it would look like if people with low incomes in our communities could actually access the services that they need and qualify for. You know, whether you're facing domestic violence and trying to get, you know, some kind of restraining order or order for protection, whether you are facing discrimination at work or in your housing, whether you're trying to access Social Security benefits that are rightfully yours. I don't know if anyone has had to interact with our federal benefit system when something goes awry, but it's an incredibly difficult system for the folks who really, I mean, people who are surviving off of their disability payments really have very, very little leeway if things get messed up and they're not getting the funds they need to survive. And so that's really what we're talking about today, is what does that look like when we fully fund this and we actually can reach everyone who qualifies for these services. So with that, happy to move on to discussion, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Beckerfin. So I just, the testifier had talked about, so some of this is emergency staffing and technology needs. And I just wondered, could you talk about, you know, usually emergency stuff, as we're seeing in other bills, once the money dries up and there's a cliff and then you come back and want it in the baseline. So could you just talk about what your intention is with the emergency portion of this funding?
That portion is not actually before us today, which is why I wanted to clarify. That'll be in the finance omnibus next week. The bill before us today is the increasing the base, increasing the tails, long-term funding the systems that we can serve people.
All right. Any follow-up, Representative Robbins?
No, I'll look forward to asking that question next time. Thank you.
Everybody will be on alert that question is coming now. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Chair Beckerfin answered my question that this $84 million would be going to the base. So that would be, going to the base. Thanks.
All right. Any other hands up? I see Representative Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott, can you please mute? All right, Representative Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Beckerfin, for bringing this bill forward. I just wanted to really emphasize how important this is. We have so many people who go to law school who don't dream of driving fancy cars or making millions of dollars. Their goal is to serve the people and to work in civil legal aid. And it's not fair of us to ask them to literally live in poverty or put their lives on hold, not be able to have children because they can't afford to because our salaries are so low. And I just want to say, I want all of those law students and all of those lawyers to be able to follow those dreams and to live like normal, healthy, productive lives and not worry about how they're going to pay their student loans or how they're going to afford to get a house or whether or not they need to, you know, wait 5 more years to start a family. And so I think this is actually incredibly important for so many people that I went to law school with and for so many people I know who are coming up in the law school system right now. So I really believe that fully funding this is, it's very crucial. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Chair Liebling.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I have a quick question, and then I also would like to make a comment. And the question was on the slide that showed that year over year, and I'm sure we've got those slides. I'd like to look at them more carefully. But the other portion of the funding was also increasing there. And could you just remind me what the other funding is coming from that was on the slide? Because you don't get 100% of your funding from the state appropriation, thank goodness, right?
So, Chair Beckerfin, I'm assuming you want to go to testifiers to answer this. All right, Ms. Rappaport.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Beckerfin, Representative Liebling. You're absolutely correct. The majority of our funding comes from the state, but we also have funding from federal sources. We have funding from private sources, local government, Legal services has a multitude of sources of revenue that we piece together in order to fund our system. And so that those other sources make up the difference between the numbers that you saw on that arc.
And then Madam Chair.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you very much. And thank you for that. I just wanted to understand the slide better. And, you know, so kind of following on what Representative Holland said, you know, legal services, is they're patching together their funding and scrambling all the time. I know I've been to numerous fundraisers and so on to try to, you know, keep things going. But I just wanted to point out from my perspective as the chair of the health committee, right now, this $84 million, you know, sounds like a lot of money when you look at, you know, the increase, but it is not a lot of money. It is not a lot of money in the context of a lot of other things that we spend our state money on. And when you think of the ramifications of having this kind of service fully funded and the downstream things that it can help and prevent, like I think one of the testifiers said about, you know, keeping people, or maybe it was the chair Becker-Finn, from, you know, keeping people from becoming homeless, et cetera. These are such important services just to make sure that people get what they already are supposed to get. And that is to be treated fairly under our system of laws. But obviously that's not self-effectuating, if that's the right word. So I just really wanted to add my support to this. I think it's super important. And I think the context of how much money is being requested here, in my world, it's not that great. So I really hope we can do this. I would love to see this. Then we would be the Minnesota that, or we would be taking a big step toward being the Minnesota that we all really have in our dreams, where everybody gets treated well. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just add on to how important this is for survivors of domestic violence. You know, we have the criminal and the civil system, and a survivor might work their way through a criminal case, but then there's the civil aspect too, and the civil needs that victims have, whether that's help with orders for protection or family law issues, and even housing and homelessness. That's a very real issue for many survivors of domestic violence. There's also issues where abusers will control their victims both emotionally and financially. And so they have lack of access to resource often because of the abuse. The children are often used for custody related issues. And then, you know, I just had a conversation with a survivor last week, and she has PTSD, and she was saying how difficult it is for her to even read court forms and understand them because of the injuries she sustained. So, and the trauma that she's endured. So I just wanted to put a plug in for that reason as well. Chair Becker-Finn, I don't see any other hands up. And if you want to go ahead and give your closing statements, please.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair Moeller. And again, I just want to emphasize, you know, to what Chair Liebling said, really the money that is saved, but also the trauma and the pain that is saved by investing in people really cannot be underestimated. And I think really when we're talking about legal aid, we are talking about whether, you know, are we okay with someone because they have lower income not having the same access to justice that other folks do who can afford private attorneys. And that's really what this is about. I also want to direct members, and also for the record, that we have letters of support have come in from Leech Lake Nation, the Minnesota State Bar Association, MACV, the Immigrant Law Center, various advocacy organizations for domestic violence and sexual assault, as well as a former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court also have lended their public support for this effort. You know, as someone who worked in the courtroom as a clerk on domestic violence order for protection calendars, I saw firsthand the work that legal aid attorneys were able to do in really supporting people when they're at some of their lowest points in accessing justice. And so that's really what this is about, and really appreciate members' support. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2739 be referred to Ways and Means.
All right, the clerk will take the roll.
Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel? Her?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
No.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Fang?
Aye.
Chung?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 2739 is on its way to Ways and Means. Chair Becker Finn, the next bill up is yours as well, House File 2738, related to public defense funding. Chair Becker Finn, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I will move House File 2738.
And I believe the motion is that it be referred to Ways and Means.
Correct. That would be my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Go ahead and tell us about your bill.
This is, again, to reference back and for the record, the conversation and the testimony that we heard earlier in our January hearing, where we heard directly from public defenders about the work that they do. And I think, you know, the important thing to remember is that public defense is not a nice thing that we do for people. It is something that we are constitutionally required to provide for our citizens. And that is in the U.S. Constitution and has been confirmed time and again in court cases as well as Supreme Court cases. And so with that, you know, we have not in so the law requires that the states provide that we provide people have a right to counsel. So this is really based in the right to counsel. And we know that. And that is, you know, one of the base pieces of our American justice system is this right to counsel. And with that, it has also been established that it is the duty of the state to fund the system of providing that counsel. And so, again, that's the Sixth Amendment and really well-settled law that is part of our system. And funding for public defense in Minnesota, as we've discussed throughout this biennium, has never even come close to being adequate to actually provide the right level of services to our citizens. And if you think about it, we're talking about criminal cases, we're talking about a person is innocent until proven guilty, another baseline part of our American justice system. And we're talking about whether their physical liberty is going to be withheld. That is really why this is such a base constitutional issue that we're talking about. And when we don't fund that system, our citizens are not actually accessing that right to the degree that they should and are. It really is their right. We have been failing for decades and decades at providing that right to our citizens. And so what this bill would do, after the testimony we had last year, after the testimony in January, this bill would provide the funding so that we could at least come close to being in the ballpark of fully funding this system so it can function at the degree that our citizens deserve. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
All right, the first testifier we have on the list is Scott Noakes. Scott, if you're here, there I see you. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Madam Vice Chair and Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Noakes. I'm retired from the U.S. Coast Guard. I retired back in 2004 after 21 years of active duty military service, and I'm now a private attorney and a part-time public defender here in Glencoe, which is in McLeod County and part of the First Judicial District. I've been involved with public defense since 2008. I handle felony cases as well as conflict cases as a part-time public defender. It is critically important, as very well outlined by Chairman Becker Finn, that public defense be fully funded because caseloads are out of control and public defenders are leaving our organization in droves for higher paying, less stressful jobs. I typically handle between 260 and 300 cases per year, which including about 300 bail hearings appearances per year, is about 600 court appearances per year. And that's a lot. As a part-time public defender, I am hired for 1,365 hours per year, or 26.25 hours per week. Doing the math, that translates to about 4.2 hours of time per client for their entire case, start to finish. That is frightening. Not surprisingly, public defenders, both part-time and full-time, end up volunteering hundreds of hours each year so that their clients can have the representation that they desperately need. In one particular case that came to my attention just recently, that a part-time public defender in the 8th Judicial District volunteered over 1,000 hours of free time in 2021. That is way beyond the call of duty and asking too much. Madam Vice Chair and Madam Chair of the, and members of the committee, the secret sauce of justice is time. Time to read police reports, time to carefully watch squad car and body cam video, time to read transcripts of interviews, time to investigate, time to talk to clients, time to assist clients with obtaining a chemical dependency evaluation and make arrangements to follow and attend an inpatient or outpatient program. Time to talk to prosecutors and try to get cases resolved short of a trial. Time to attend a trial, if that's necessary. That takes 2 or 3 days on average. If a client is found guilty, time to prepare for and attend sentencing. And on and on and on. However, as opposed to the secret sauce method, what public defenders across Minnesota are often required to do, unfortunately, because of high caseloads, is engage in fast food justice, served at the speed of light. As mentioned by Chairman Becker Finn, that approach is not contemplated under the U.S. Constitution, in particular the case of Gideon versus Wainwright, the case that mandated that by our Supreme Court of the United States that every state, including Minnesota, must establish a public defense system as a guaranteed fundamental right under the Sixth Amendment of our Constitution. Indigent members of our community that are charged with crimes ought to be afforded a real chance at justice, not just the illusion of justice. To our credit, Minnesota has one of the best public defense systems in the country. However, there is plenty of room for improvement. Guiding our clients through the criminal justice system, getting them back on track, rehabilitated, and becoming productive members of our community again is in the best interest of all of us. Fully funding public defense will attract well-qualified candidates to be public defenders and will help retain the loyal and dedicated staff that I'm very proud to be a part of. I respectfully urge you to pass HF 2738, and I am happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Heidi Hovis. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hovis, and I'm an assistant public defender and Teamster Local 320 steward. I practice in the 7th District, which covers central Minnesota and extends west. It includes Becker, Benton, Clay, Douglas, Mille Lacs, Morrison, Otter Tail, Stearns, Todd, and Wadena counties. Public defender caseloads in greater Minnesota are untenable. In Clay County, Moorhead, full-time public defenders have between 220 and 250 cases, with over 100 of those cases being at the felony level. In Becker County, Detroit Lakes, full-time defenders have 160 open files, with 70 at the felony level. In Stearns County, St. Cloud, my colleague on the felony team has 207 cases open today. I'm on the misdemeanor team and I have 242 cases. We hired a new attorney 4 months ago. She is learning to be a criminal defense attorney, learning to be a lawyer, while handling over 300 cases. Part-time defenders in the 7th are also overwhelmed. On average, attorneys with a 75% contract have over 170 cases, with a majority at the felony level. 90% of Minnesota's criminal cases are handled by public defenders. Think about all the private criminal defense attorneys and firms in our state. their business thrives on access to only 10% of the market. So what do public defenders do for their hundreds of clients? Like Scott said, we handle bail hearings and arraignment hearings. After appointment by the court, public defenders review evidence used in charging the crime. This often includes reading pages of police reports, reviewing statements from witnesses, watching dash cam video, body cam video, surveillance video. We file motions, write memorandums of law, make legal arguments. We assert the constitutional rights of our clients at trial. And we communicate with our clients in jail meeting rooms, in our offices, over the phone. We explain the legal process, demystify legal jargon, and help our clients understand their rights and options. We keep low-level offenders out of prison, which has a real cost savings to the state. In Minnesota, the annual cost of a prison inmate is over $40,000 a year. As they say, you cannot pour from an empty cup. Public defenders are empty. When caseloads are as high as they are in outstate Minnesota, we cannot work enough hours to get everything done. We cannot provide client-centered practice, dig into case law, or strategize for trial. We simply don't have the time. And because of that, public defenders are leaving, quitting, taking their knowledge and experience with them. We need the public defense system fully funded so we can hire staff necessary to adjust caseloads. We need your support to do the important work of defending, providing that necessary check on police power and ensuring our clients' constitutional rights. It is only when our caseloads are manageable that we can provide the zealous representation our clients deserve, our justice partners desire, and our state needs. Thank you.
Thank you. And we also have Taylor Harrison. And if you can keep your testimony to about 2 minutes or less, that would be great, please. We do have a full agenda. And I think Mr. Noak said time is the secret sauce in your work, and it's the secret sauce in our work, too. So Taylor, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Taylor Harrison. I am a dispositional advisor at the 6th District Public Defender's Office in Northeast Minnesota and a Teamsters Local 320 steward. In my role as dispositional advisor, I assist and advise the public defender attorneys in their efforts to provide holistic criminal defense to our clients. Most of my time is spent interviewing my clients and advocating for access to treatment or other services. Most of the people that I serve are struggling with mental health issues, insecure housing, and addiction. Often I write reports to the court about my clients' lived experiences in an attempt to help the court understand how this person got to this point in their life. I am frequently tasked with creating alternative sentencing plans that serve the needs of my clients and help create safer communities by addressing mental illness and addiction instead of sending people to prison. In addition to creating safer communities in the long run, these alternatives are also generally more cost-effective. When we are overworked and understaffed, as we are right now, it is difficult to or impossible to provide the zealous advocacy that our clients and all criminal defendants deserve. I am currently assigned to over 120 open cases. With that many cases, I am always struggling with the needs of one versus the needs of many. I am acutely aware that if I spend time on one case, I am taking time away from someone else. This isn't justice. If I don't have the time to properly build relationships with my clients, get to know their needs, their stories, and their cases, I struggle to provide the advocacy that they need and deserve. The people on my caseload are some of the most traumatized, disenfranchised, mentally ill, resilient, and inspiring people that exist in our society. My clients deserve the decency of having attorneys and defense teams with the time to get to know them and their cases. We need enough staff to bring our caseloads down to manageable levels and enough resources to retain our experienced staff. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We now have time for member questions. Give everybody a minute here. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real brief. I just wanted to thank the testifiers so much for their incredible work. And Mr. Noakes spoke of the Gideon versus Wainwright case. We have a proud Minnesota connection to that case, and that Walter Mondale led the state attorneys general that filed the amicus brief in that case, and he said it was the most important case he ever worked on. And I don't think we're living up to that promise, as you said so well, Mr. Noakes, of providing adequate representation, which is, as the Supreme Court noted, constitutionally guaranteed to Minnesotans under that case. And to hear Ms. Hovis and Ms. Harrison talk about trying to juggle hundreds of cases, I just can't imagine how you do it. And certainly you shouldn't be asked to. You should not be expected to carry that level of caseload and try to provide the best representation possible to your clients. So I just want to thank Chair Becker-Finn for her real leadership and pushing hard on trying to fully fund our public defender systems and strongly support this effort.
All right, thank you. Other questions from members, questions or comments? All right, a couple of hands just popped up all at once. All right, Representative Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Chair Becker-Finn for bringing this legislation forward. I wasn't going to speak because I get kind of emotional about this, because I think public defenders, I believe that they are, that it's like the most noble profession that one can have. And I don't know how many of you know what it's like to practice law, but when you don't get to choose your clients, when they fall in your laps, when they are, often people who are at the lowest point of their life for whatever reason and struggle with such an array of difficulties. I mean, when people like that would come into my office when I was practicing law, when I was practicing family law, I could say, oh, I don't think so. We're not going to take that. We're not going to take that case. That doesn't sound like a good case. No, it doesn't sound like you have a really strong position here, or, there's just, you get to choose, and public defenders don't get to choose that. They're doing the work of the Constitution. They're doing the work of the people that we have promised, what we've promised our citizens would be available to them. And it's so important that they can do that work well. And it's so important that they have the support that they need to be effective in this. And when I hear the amount of time that's average to spend on a case, when I hear about average caseloads, I it just makes me feel like we've failed. We've failed our people in the promise that we made to them in Gideon versus Rainway. And, it's really painful to me. And so I don't want to just ramble here, but I want to say thank you for all of the work that all of you have done. I want to say thank you to Chair Becker-Finn for bringing this forward. I want to say, we're here to support what you're doing. We're here to back you up, because I think everybody on this committee believes in the Constitution. And I think everybody on this committee supports the Constitution. And as this is a constitutional right, we really need to think carefully about how we are going to fund this and how we are going to make sure that our promise to Minnesotans is kept. So thank you so much. I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, for bringing this. I mean, we talk quite a bit about the work of public defenders. So I am a former public defender, and everything that Representative Hollins said is absolutely true. Don't get to choose the individuals that you represent. But what you do know that you're doing is that you are oftentimes, and in most cases, you're the last thing standing between them and their liberties that may be taken away. And you get them at a point where they're terrified, they're scared, their families are worried. They are really concerned about how this is going to impact their life. And I remember several nights, several days, several weeks, where you need to do more work on the case that you're working on. You want to give them everything you have to ensure that they get the best representation possible. And you just can't. You can't do it because you don't have the time, because the caseload is overwhelming, the caseload is crushing. You've got clients sitting in jail that are waiting on you to come visit them. You're making late night visits because you're working up or prepping for a trial that you have that week. It is something that we promised that we take care of. It's enshrined in our documents. Our courts have over and over again said how important it is and that it must be done. And we truly are judged on how we provide resources for our most vulnerable. That's why I'm happy to support this bill. And thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, for bringing it, continuing to push and fight for those that are most vulnerable in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. I don't see any other member hands up. So Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to give us your closing remarks?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to our testifiers. I think there are very few things as a state that we are constitutionally required to fund. There are a lot of, you know, a lot of times we talk about, you know, rights to housing or jobs or to operate a business, all these other rights, but this is actually one that is has been affirmed time and a time again as a constitutional right that is guaranteed to our citizens. And if we are not, you know, we say the Pledge of Allegiance every day when we're on the House floor. And I used to, when I was younger, I always focused on the justice for all, but it really is the liberty and justice for all that we're talking about. And so I think that, you know, if we don't provide that to our citizens, and we are essentially our system right now, and what the status quo is that, you know, by default, we're all sort of accepting as reality, is that if you don't have as much money, that liberty and justice for all is not attainable to you in the way it is for people with more wealth. And I'm not okay with that. And I hope that nobody's okay with that. That should not be the way we decide what happens to you and your freedom. So that's what this, you know, these efforts are really about. And I think, you know, it's really important to mention too, you know, this isn't a partisan issue. Chair Limmer in the Senate included this $50 million funding in his omnibus finance bill because, you know, there is recognition across the board that we're talking about constitutional rights here. And I think that's really, really important. You know, there, everybody on this committee, whether yourself, a family member, a friend, or a neighbor, at some point has needed a public defender or will need a public defender. And when that time comes, I mean, how many of you would know how to represent yourself if you were charged with a crime or if something happened to you and there was confusion and you were arrested? How many of you would be able to do that on your own? And I don't think the outcome of what happens after that point should be determined by how much money you have. And that is what these efforts are really about, in that all of our citizens should have the same rights when it comes to these, again, your actual freedom to be, to your liberty to be walking around in your community and contributing to your community. And so I really appreciate all the efforts and appreciate all of the co-authors on the bill. Like I said, it's a nonpartisan, bipartisan effort, and I'm just happy that we can move it forward today. So with that, Madam Chair, I will renew my motion that House File 2738 be referred to Ways and Means.
The clerk will take the roll.
Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist? Representative Feist? Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel? Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
No. Aye.
Farr?
All
right. Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
I see Representative Feist.
Aye.
That is 15 ayes and one nay.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 2738 is on its way to the Ways and Means Committee. The next bill we have up is House File 1404. Again, Chair Becker-Finn, this is our going to be our data practices policy omnibus bill. Chair Becker-Finn, would you like to move that House File 1404 be referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1404 be referred to the General Register, and then I will go ahead and move the DE5 amendment. And just to clarify for members, because the split in the Senate with Chair Matthews' committee, which is the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, and then with Chair Limmer having the Finance Committee, that's why we have this policy omnibus that really matches up with the work that Chair Matthews is doing. So that's why there's the distinction there. So would move the DE5. And you know, once we get that adopted, nonpartisan staff will walk through what's included.
All right. Any discussion to the DE5 amendment before we vote on it? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE5 amendment is adopted. And Chair Becker-Finn, do you have opening comments about the bill as amended before we move to staff? Okay, so you're nodding your head. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just real quickly, you know, this is an omnibus. It's the culmination of things that we have already heard. There's not really any big surprises in the bill. These are things that we've vetted and taken testimony on throughout the biennium. You know, there are a couple of pieces here and there where we cleaned up language and improved the bill. But other than that, there shouldn't be anything in here that's brand new for folks. We're just a true omnibus putting together what we've worked on all session. And with that, would turn it over to nonpartisan staff to do the walkthrough.
All right. I believe both Mary Mullen and Nathan Hopkins from nonpartisan staff will do that walkthrough. So please go ahead and lead us through that.
Madam Chair and members, first I'd like to point out there are some amendments to the DE5 that should be considered before the DE5 is adopted. So the committee might want to reconsider its last vote so that it can hear the amendments to the DE5 and then adopt the DE5 as amended.
All right. My apologies about that. So I'm not sure what the motion needs to be to make that happen.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
I think it would be a motion to reconsider the DE5.
All right. Thank you very much. So the motion is to reconsider the DE5 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. All right. Now we will go ahead and go through the walkthrough.
Madam Chair and members, this is Nathan Hopkins with Nonpartisan House Research. I'm going to walk through Article 1 of the DE5, which deals with government data practices and privacy issues, and then I'll turn it over to Mary Mullen for the following articles. In Article 1, Sections 1 through 7, those deal with the Safe at Home program, the Address Confidentiality program that's administered by the Secretary of State's office, the underlying bill for those amendments is House File 3249, and that has passed the House floor with a vote of 131-0. Moving on, Section 8 of Article 1. This is from House File 3064, which was carried by Representative Jordan. This classifies as private or non-public tax returns or bank account statements that are submitted to political subdivisions, so local governments mainly, as part of an application for a license. It also imposes a destruction requirement for that data. And that's new language for since the last time the committee has heard that bill. Section 9 is from House File 341, which was carried by Representative Feist. This is the Student Data Privacy Act, and this is the definition section. Section 10, it contains language from two different bills, both of them carried by Chair Becker-Finn. House File 1407 allowed data to be disclosed to tribal nations about tribally enrolled or descendant students. And House File 3195 addressed directory information. And as it is in the DE here, it allows student personal contact information to be disclosed to a government entity that's providing some kind of school-sponsored service or activity and that has a legitimate educational interest in that contact information. Section 11 is the remainder of Chair Becker-Fenn's House File 3195, and this prohibits educational institutions from designating a student's personal contact information as directory information. So that contact information then will remain private. Section 12, this is from the Student Data Privacy Act. This places the transparency obligations and privacy protective restrictions on technology providers that are working with schools. Section 13, this is also from the Student Data Privacy Act. It addresses privacy issues surrounding school-issued technology devices, hardware, or software. Section 14 is from the Student Data Privacy Act. This addresses the exemption for post-secondary institutions and nonprofit national assessment providers, such as the College Board. Section 15, Education Support Services Data. This is from Representative Feist's House File 2353, which is also passed the House floor. This section defines education support services data and classifies it as private data on individuals. Section 16 is from House File 2945, which was chief authored by Representative Herr. This language has also passed the House floor. This permits a law enforcement agency that performs a background check related to employment or licensing with the city or county to disseminate the criminal history data to the hiring or licensing authority of the city or county that requested the background check. Finally, Section 17, which is the last section here in Article 1, this is the mobile tracking device bill, which is from House File 2910, carried by Representative Mueller. And this permits law enforcement to attach a mobile tracking device to a stolen vehicle without prior court approval if the owner grants consent or reports to law enforcement that the vehicle was stolen. And Madam Chair, if you'll recognize Mary Mullins, she'll move on to Article 2 of the DE.
Thank you. Mary Mullins, go ahead, please.
Chair and members, this is Mary Mullen from the House Research Department. I'm going to walk you through the next couple articles. We'll start with Article 2, which begins at the top of page 17 if you're reading the DE, and page 3 if you're on the bill summary. Article 2, all of Article 2 is the Uniform Canadian Judgments Bill that we heard. The whole article addresses a process to register a Canadian court judgment for money in Minnesota. This process is in addition to the existing process for registering a foreign money judgment from another jurisdiction, but it simplifies the filing and notice procedure. It's a uniform law that was drafted by the Uniform Laws Commission, and it's been enacted in Colorado, Nevada, Nebraska, and Rhode Island. I'm going to move on to Article 3, which is an article related to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So all the sections here do amend sections of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. This article starts on the page, top of page 24 in the DE. The first section in this article adds a definition for race to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The definition provides that race is inclusive of traits associated with race, and the definition also provides that hair texture and hairstyles can be included in the traits historically associated with race. The second section is inquiries into pay history. This section prevents employers, including labor unions and employment agencies, job applicants' pay history, but it doesn't prevent a job applicant from volunteering their past pay if the employer does not prompt them or require them to provide it. The next section is Section 3, which makes it a violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to deny access to closed captioning to a person who needs it in a place of public accommodation when television access is available to others. Section 4 removes an exemption that currently exists for duplex owners to discriminate against a renter on the basis of sexual orientation. Section 5 prohibits healthcare providers and entities responsible for matching anatomical gifts from limiting an individual's access to anatomical gifts and related services based on an individual's race or ethnicity. And then at the end of Article 3, we have a couple of repealers. And the two repealers they have here is an exception to the human rights law for employment discrimination based on sexual orientation for certain nonprofit organizations. And another repealer, it repeals a section of the Human Rights Act that's related to the construction of the law. Article 4 starts at the top of page 30. amends a variety of different civil law provisions, including provisions related to marriage licenses, name changes, indemnity service contracts, civil penalties, and guardianships. So sections 1 and 2 relate to conservation officers and other licensed police officers the authority to issue a civil citation to someone who violates snowmobile provisions. And I think if you remember this bill, it also increases some of the penalties, and it requires civil penalties for citations established in the previous section that involves snowmobiles to be deposited in snowmobiles trails in a very specific fund for those. Section 3 and 14 of Article 4 make technical changes to clarify the rules that apply to filing and serving a challenge to a civil asset forfeiture. Sections 4 and 5 allow a person to change their name after a dissolution of marriage without paying a filing fee and without a national criminal history check, so long as the person provides a certified copy of their marriage dissolution court order and a certified copy of their birth certificate. Section 6 and 7 create a juvenile court guardianship for at-risk youth. Sections 8, 9, 10, and 11 allow notaries to have the power to perform a civil marriage, along with the other powers that notaries are granted when they have a valid notary commission, and make accommodating changes in various statutes to allow for that. Section 12 allows people to apply for marriage licenses virtually. This was a temporary provision that was passed during the pandemic, and this bill would make it permanent. Section 13 clarifies indemnity application where insurance coverage exists in design professional service contracts. And Section 15 permits an emancipated minor to seek a restraining order on that person's own behalf if the court determines that it's in the best interest of the child. And that is the whole bill.
All right, thank you, Ms. Mullen and Mr. Hopkins. Members, we have one testifier that signed up, so I think we'll move to that testifier, and then we'll go to the amendments and then to member discussion. We have Julia Decker from the ACLU. Ms. Decker, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chair Mueller, and I didn't realize I was the only testifier to sign up, so I will be very brief, but Madam Chair, members, Julia Decker, Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We just wanted to thank Chair Becker-Finn for including the Student Data Privacy Act in this omnibus bill. We're also very grateful to Representative Feist and Representative Scott for their ongoing work and advocacy on this issue, and also to this committee for its support of the bill. This is critically important and urgently needed. It will better protect the civil liberties of Minnesota students. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right, thank you. Well, let's move on to the amendments. And I'm getting some information from staff that we should probably do a roll call on each of those amendments. So we will go ahead and do that. Let's see. Chair Becker-Finn, I believe you're going to offer the A2.
Madam Chair, I will move the A2 amendment. This is to the Representative Mueller provision regarding GPS tracking. It just makes it effective right away. So pretty simple, just a time change on that one. So I will move the A2 amendment to the DE.
Any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right, seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel? Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Damani?
No.
Farr?
All right.
Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 15 ayes and 1 nay.
The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. The next amendment is the A3 amendment. Representative Long, I believe that is your amendment. Would you like to move the A3 amendment and explain it?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the A3 amendment. And the A3 amendment may look familiar because it is House File 1156, Representative Fisher's Digital Fair Repair Bill, We passed this bill out of committee last month, but I think it would be appropriate to include it in the policy omnibus for our committee. As a refresher, this amendment, the bill gives consumers the choice of where to get their electronics fixed. Original equipment manufacturers must share with consumers or independent repair providers the instructions, parts, and tools to repair digital electronics sold or used in Minnesota at a fair and reasonable cost. This was based off the 2012 Massachusetts law that became part of a nationwide MOU with the auto industry, and there are some exemptions in the bill for medical devices, motor vehicles, and trade secrets. I know we've already debated this bill, so I'd ask for member support.
Any discussion to the A3 amendment? All right, I'm not seeing any. The clerk will take the roll on the A3 amendment.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel, excused. Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
No.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Fang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 6 nays.
The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. The next amendment is the A4 amendment. I believe Representative Herr, that is your amendment. If you'd like to move your amendment and explain it, please. Representative Herr, I know that she might be jumping between committees, but I also don't know if she has some technical problems, so we'll just pause here for just a second. All right, she's not hopping on, so let's move to the A5 amendment, which I believe is Representative Scott's amendment. Representative Scott, would you like to move your amendment and explain it to the committee?
Yes, Matt, I would move the A5 amendment, and what it does is it simply adds audit trails and role-based access for educational support services data, and I would ask for member support.
Thank you. Discussion to the A5 amendment. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure, Representative Scott, is your understanding that this wouldn't cost the county anything to add this to what they're already doing?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They did indicate in the committee's hearing that their software already created audit trails. So that's what I recall them saying anyway, Madam Chair.
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you. Yep, just wanted to clarify, Representative Scott. I would encourage members to support the amendment.
Okay, the clerk will take the roll on the A5 amendment.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel, excused. Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Amatney?
Aye.
Farr?
Farr, aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Vang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and 0 nays.
The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted. All right, we'll circle back to the A4 amendment. Representative Herr, I believe that is your amendment.
It is, Madam Chair. Oops, my apologies. I'm trying to multitask here, Madam Chair. I'm so sorry. Yes, Madam Chair, the A4 is my amendment, and what that is just changing the effective date for the pay discrimination bill that was included in the omnibus, and so I would just ask for the committee's support of the effective date change.
All right. Representative Herr has moved her amendment. Explain the amendment. Is there any discussion to it? All right. Seeing no discussion on that, the clerk will take the roll on the A4.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist? Representative Feist? Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel excused. Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Novotny?
No.
Barr?
Or no.
Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
And Feist?
Aye.
That is 11 ayes and 5 nays.
The motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. I don't see that we have any further amendments to the amendment at the desk. So now we can move on to member discussions. I'll give you time to raise your hand here. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Beckerson, thanks for putting a fairly decent bill together. There are some provisions in there that I don't care for, but I really am appreciative of putting the student data privacy piece in here. And I know Representative Jordan is not on this call, but wanted to thank her for working to get the right language on her bill. I think that was an important piece that to be included in this bill so that we can protect those businesses that are applying there in Minneapolis. We can protect their such things as their tax returns and that sort of thing from being available to the public. So there are some other good provisions in here, Madam Chair, but there's some, like I said, that I don't agree with. So I'll be a no today, but thank you for putting a bill together that addresses some of these good issues.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Further discussion from members? All right. Let's see here. I think that we need to, hang on a second, got to back up here because we moved all those amendments. And we need to vote on the DE as amended, I believe. Can I get a confirmation from staff that that's what we need to do? Our Chair Beckerfin, go ahead.
Yes, that is Nathan Hopkins was giving us the thumbs up. So that is the motion. And I would just say, I really appreciate the civil law data realm being relatively nonpartisan. And I really appreciate everyone who's worked on things. I do want to note, too, that my bill on the directory information, we did make some tweaks to that to address some of the concerns that came up. So really appreciative to our nonpartisan staff for helping this bill be as good as it could be. So, yes, I believe that's the motion, Madam Chair.
All right. So Chair Beckerfin renews her motion on the DE amendment as amended. I'm seeing some head nods. All right. Got that right. The clerk will take the roll.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Muller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel excused. Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
No. Novotny, no.
Barr?
Barr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and the DE5 as amended is adopted. And let's see, do we have any final discussion to the bill? Chair Beckerfin?
Madam Chair, I just, again, just appreciate the work on this bill throughout. I mean, this really is, if you get into some of the provisions, go back to last year, things that we didn't make it across the finish line in the omnibus last year, but I think are still good things that we're trying to get done. And I am hopeful that we'll be able to continue to move these issues forward this year. So just appreciate all the efforts, especially nonpartisan staff putting together an omnibus, a policy omnibus, a little bit earlier than some of the folks working on their finance omnibus bills. So just really appreciate our nonpartisan staff, as always.
All right. And with that, Chair Becker-Finn will renew her motion that House File 1404, as amended, be referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier? Representative Frazier? Grossel excused. Her?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
Aye, no.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Fang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
Frazier?
Frazier, aye.
That is 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 1404, as amended, is on its way to the General Register. And I will turn the virtual gavel back over to Chair Becker-Finn.
Yep, thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. Just to give folks a heads up for next week, so next week we will be doing our finance omnibus again that will match up with Chair Limmer's committee. So we will get that posted as soon as we can, but did want to give folks a heads up that that is the plan for next week, that we would meet at our regular morning times on Tuesday and Thursday. And then would also note that I'm pretty certain we'll be able to pull it off, but I think Thursday we were likely be meeting in person in Capitol 120, a hybrid hearing. Thought as long as the numbers were pretty good right now and we're wrapping up the year, that it would be nice to meet in person at least once this biennium. And so that is the plan for next Thursday, that we'll be in Capitol 120, and appreciate folks probably having to get up a little bit earlier to get there by 8:30. But I think it'll be worth it. So that's the plan for next week. Any other questions before we adjourn for the week? All right. Not seeing any. Thank you, members, for your good work today. And thank you to our testifiers and everybody else. We'll see you next week. With that, we are adjourned.